Worlds collide in this crossover with We Hate Movies as we review the second part of the Clint Goes Ape duology, Any Which Way You Can. Hey everyone, and welcome to the Flophouse. I'm Dan McCoy.
Welcome to the Flophouse. I'm Stuart.
Hi. Welcome. Threw me off, Stuart, that you didn't say your last name. Yeah, and no, welcome to the Flophouse. I'm Elliot Kalin.
I like to
Kalin.
Keep you guessing.
Yeah.
As to how much you're going to forget of your own name.
Exactly.
This time it was one half. So this is a bit of a special episode of the Flophouse.
We're going to learn a lesson. It's a very special episode of the Flophouse. Stuart, you have an addiction to fun. And Dan, I'm divorcing you.
Okay.
Whoa, it's a double special episode.
It's two specials, yeah.
You and Stuart still love me the same, right? Even though
You're kind of the reason that, yeah.
You're the reason I'm having too much fun is because, I don't know, your vanilla humanness has bored me.
What?
He's got to make up for it by having too much fun.
Okay. This is actually a special episode because
it's the part two of a pod crawl.
Yes, we have teamed up in a, let's call it a Marvel DC style crossover.
We're Marvel.
With
awesome.
With We Hate Movies.
So I'm Venom, you're Gambit.
And why am I Gambit?
And Dan Cyclops.
You're
right?
Gambit, Dan Cyclops, I'm Beast.
Can I be Carnage?
Why would you want to be Carnage?
Because he's cool.
He's a terrible character.
Okay, continue, Dan.
Point is, popular bad movie podcast, We Hate Movies, watched Every Which Way But Loose.
The first iconic Clint Eastwood orangutan bare-knuckle fist-fighting trucker movie.
Mm-hmm. And we're
part of the
up
Which Way series of movies.
Of which there are two.
For now. Yeah.
And we're bringing up the rear of the duology with Any Which Way You Can.
Yeah, Stuart, you raised an interesting point. When are they going to do the reboot of the series where Clint Eastwood hands off the orangutan to a younger generation?
Yeah, there's like a Channing Tatum or Tatum Channing, I don't know.
Whichever way you want to do it. Any which way you can say his name. Uh-huh. Channing
and
Tatum.
The monkey
may,
will be played
Cam
by...
Cam
ape. He's an ape.
He's okay. Not a monkey. He's an orangutan, which is an ape, and not a monkey.
So any jokes using the phrase monkey business automatically DQ'd.
Let's just ban right now. Monkey business, monkeying around. Hey, hey, we're the monkeys. Monkey wrench. Or, I don't know, like...
If you really like the movie, you can't say you're going ape over it.
No, you can say
ape. Oh, I can say that.
Yeah,
awesome.
Yeah.
He's a great ape. He's okay. One of the apes.
Yeah, he's a really great ape. He's a great ape. A
I mean, he
example.
Was. Spoiler alert, that ape died.
Okay, well, why don't we bring
not
it
old
down
age either, is
at
it?
The very beginning by talking about animal cruelty.
Well, this movie is a great example of animal cruelty.
So if you
it was
you,
cruel to us, the human animal.
The human animal.
So if you,
as Desmond Morris would say.
If you want to learn what we're talking about, you can run on over to We Hate Movies and listen to their first installment where they talk about the first one.
And then come back to us right now for the second installment where we talk about this movie, which is now. So Any Which Way You Can. It's the sequel, right? Some would say squeakquel, but they'd be wrong. There are no squeaking animals in this.
That is
orangutans, according to this movie, make the sound of farts with their mouths and also punch people.
Yeah.
A lot of punch sound effects and tearing cars apart.
This whoever invented the punch sound effect made a lot of royalties off this movie, let me tell you. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of smacking of lips between Clyde and...
They kiss once.
I don't... I mean, he kisses a lot of people,
he
though.
Does, that's true.
He kisses
true.
A guy in a bar.
But he only kisses Clint Eastwood once.
Okay.
It reminded me... The whole time I just kept thinking about the episode of The Critic where he watches one of these movies and Clint Eastwood's asleep and Clyde starts kissing him and he goes, "Someone's kissing me. It must be a beautiful woman. Now I'll make sweet love to you without opening my eyes the entire time." That's kind of not that far from the movie in a lot of ways.
Yeah, we'll get into that. I feel
are we
like,
going to... Now, this is going to be a hard movie to summarize because there's very little plot.
Yeah, well, this is the part of the show usually where Elliot would summarize the movie. I feel like this movie was made as a cruel joke to you. Somehow Clint Eastwood would be like,
Someday there's going to be a punk who's going to try and make fun of me. I'm going to make it as hard as possible.
It's not a bad Clint Eastwood impression.
It's not a bad
Clint Eastwood. Have you been working on that
one? Now, what would happen if Clint Eastwood met Michael Caine?
I think it would go a little something like this. Hey, Michael. Hello, my friend Clint Eastwood. And scene.
Okay, now what if Dracula was there?
Oh, Clint Eastwood of the night. What beautiful music you make.
Okay, now Henry Kissinger's there.
I can't believe I'm meeting Clint Eastwood.
That's pretty good. It's pretty good. Okay, now what does Clint Eastwood say to Henry Kissinger? Because they're both Republicans.
Stay the course, buddy. You're doing a great job.
Okay, now what does Pee Wee Herman say when he gets there?
I can't
it's
do it.
It's terrible. Wow.
Terrible one.
I was ready
to
go.
It was more of a goofy than anything.
Look, there's a reason.
So it was a great
that was like a dog man.
It was a great Pinto Colvig impression.
There's a reason they call me not the next Rich Little.
Yeah, they do call you that. Yeah. Not necessarily the Rich Little.
Yeah. So wait.
So this movie,
movie is like if somebody drew a bunch of cartoons of scenes featuring the same characters on a poster, and then you just kind of looked at it all at once.
It's like a Jack Davis poster.
It is one of those things. You're watching it, you're like, is this like an adaptation of a book of short stories about Philo and Clyde, the bare knuckle boxer and his orangutan buddy?
Yeah, There was.
It some takes a long time for any sort of story to kick in.
There was some sort of blue collar P.G. Woodhouse out there that they discovered these stories.
Peggy Woodhouse, a stay at home mom in Billings, decided to write
this. A real Murders in the Rue morgue.
Well, not at all in any way, except it has an orangutan in it.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Although Clyde, you have to assume, murdered a number of people. Sure. He punches a lot of people in this so hard that they are immediately knocked out, probably dead. So anyway, here's the movie. So the first movie.
I want to hear where you start with this.
The first movie established that Clint Eastwood as Philo Beddoe, a truck driver, bare knuckle boxer, with his best friend Orville and an orangutan named Clyde, who he just happens to have around.
So the orangutan has the most normal name of the three of them.
Of Philo, Orville, and Clyde. Yeah, I guess so. They also live with Ruth Gordon, Orville's mom.
The actor Ruth Gordon.
Well, the character played by Ruth Gordon in the role of sassy old lady.
Yeah.
Does she have sex in this movie? Yes, she does.
You better believe
we'll get there. She kicks a guy in the nuts, then has sex with him. We call it the old Ruth Gordon.
Sure. That's to swell up his genitals.
Well, that's why if you hire a prostitute and you say, give me a Ruth Gordon, she kicks you in the nuts and then has sex with you.
Yeah. Cleveland Ruth Gordon is a different thing, though.
Yeah. That's when you do it in Cleveland. You just name it after whatever city you're in at the time. Give me a Newark Ruth Gordon. Yeah. Sorry, we're in Boise.
And if you're on the...
It's going to take a while.
If you're on the space station, you say, give me a space Ruth Gordon.
Oh, yeah, of course, because everything's space in space.
Yep.
Hand me that space soda. I want a space drink and so forth. Mm-hmm. I need a space straw.
Mm-hmm. Costs a lot of space bucks, that space Ruth Gordon.
Can you give me a space massage? I'm feeling a lot of space aches in my space shoulders.
Sure. Such a waste of time.
Do you want a happy space ending?
Yeah.
And so forth. That's a space massage thing. Don't go into those space parlors. They're just, they're not good for you.
So this movie takes place
in
space.
So in the first movie, they live in California. It's a very blue-collar milieu. And this is a movie that was made at a time, late 70s, early 80s. This movie came out in 1980 when it was like kind of the beginning of the end of the era of the Hollywood making a lot of movies about blue-collar people.
Let's call it the Hal Needham era,
even though
this was not directed by him.
I mean, it's Hal Needham-ish in which case, because there's a lot of like car chasing and fist fighting, but there were
if
movies
CB
like,
radios
say,
was a genre, then that would be these types of films.
Because then there were other movies that were like Fat City about blue-collar people that is not Hal Needham-esque in any way.
Sure.
So, but you got your two strains of blue-collar movie. You're low-key character studies about depressing stuff, and your Hal Needham-type movies about fist fights in bars and honky-tonk music and orangutans riding around in trucks.
Beer trucks.
Let's face it, date raping other orangutans.
Smashing into things.
As we'll get to it. But anyway, so that's the first movie established those things. And Sandra Locke, Clint Eastwood's at the time real-life girlfriend, plays his movie love interest, but they have a falling out. So this movie
In the movie, she's running a scam on him, and he keeps following around. Like, the whole point, like, the title of the movie is about this.
Yeah.
So it has nothing to do with the orangutan on the poster.
Which makes, if the orangutan's on the poster, again, he should be the star of the movie. Or
yeah, it's what made it the second highest grossing film,
right?
Of
yeah, I mean, and now this movie didn't do as well as that one. This movie was only the fifth highest grossing movie in 1980. But so this movie starts off. Clint Eastwood has his last bare knuckle fight for a while in a quarry or an oil refinery pit or something.
Yeah, someplace. Like that.
It looks like where the good guys live in Road Warrior, basically.
Yeah.
But it's in the middle of somewhere in California.
Yeah, and this is one of these movies that we've talked about before where people are famous for things they should never be famous for.
He is a bare knuckle pit fighter, but he's somehow incredibly famous.
He's a legend. He's a legend. The land.
And he's not famous for being the guy who drives around with a fucking orangutan.
No, he's famous for being a great fist fighter. And if anything, the orangutan is seen as not particularly out of the ordinary or even worth mentioning. The two times people talk about it, one time at the very end of the movie, a cop tries to arrest him for having this orangutan. The beginning of the movie, they're in a bar, and a guy looks to he's sitting next to Clyde at the bar. Because, of course, Clyde gets to go in the bar and drink because this is this. Okay,
because the coach from Major League is the bartender, and he's cool with
hey, here's yeah. what I'm going to posit. It's because he sits down, and the guy on the bar's like, I don't like sitting next to dirty apes. Not in a way like, what the fuck, there's an ape in this bar, but in the way of like a racist would say it. So yeah. It's almost like I'm going to posit this takes place in a universe where it's like, One of the middle stages between Conquest of the Planet of the Apes and Planet of the Apes, where apes are like just finally starting to get their civil rights, but there's still a lot of racists out there who are not cool with it and have decided that they're just going to cause trouble for apes. Either that or then there's a zoo that has orangutans. Well,
but
in there, it,
but
so
there's
I don't
also
know.
Like a scene later on. There is one scene later on where they check into a hotel and they have to like dress Clyde up in like a nightdress.
It's like a Mandy
like,
Yoakam
oh,
costume.
My Aunt Flo or whatever. Like and
Aunt Flo. Well, that's
yeah. They dress Clyde up as the concept of menstruation.
No, but such an this is a really elaborate outfit.
But no, it's,
Clyde, I don't think this idea is really getting across.
But I don't.
Hopefully, they'll think it's clever rather than funny.
Yeah, yeah.
But like that's what,
well, they're not going to think it's funny because it's in this movie and almost nothing in it is.
But that's the only time that they make any bow to the idea that, like, oh, maybe not every establishment would be welcoming of orangutans.
So they are, which orangutans, as we know from Murders in the Rue Marg, are notorious murderers. Mm-hmm. And I know I said Murders in the Rue Marg, which sounds like Rue Marge. Which, if the Simpsons,
but luckily Dan was laughing.
If
and
the
couldn't
Simpsons
jump on it.
Knew what it was doing. They'd on the Halloween episode, they'd have Murder in the Rue Marge, mm-hmm. where Marge is attacked by, or I guess Homer is the orangutan,
yeah.
it, right?
Okay.
It's basically the King Homer cartoon from the other Treehouse of Horror episode. But anyway, getting back to the movie because we're about 30 seconds into it. Clint Eastwood has a fight at this place. He says, that's my last fight. Clyde takes a moment to shit on the seat of a police car because mm-hmm. Clyde hates the cops. Let's just say that. He's not a big fan of the pigs and so forth.
Well, he's like a free spirit.
So the character
he's like a coyote trickster spirit.
He is. That's true. He is he's the rabbit figure of so many African tales.
Yeah.
Personified
in Western culture by Spider-Man.
I don't think
not
that's
exactly
necessarily. The mythology, I don't think, lines up down the line.
I mean, not
that
completely,
way.
But hear him out. Okay, let's.
You know, let's continue with the movie before I go on a dissertation about how Spider-Man is similar to Coyote.
Okay.
No, we've got time. Come on, Stuart.
So, then the characters basically hang around for a long time. Clint Eastwood goes to this honky-tonk bar and sees Sandra Locke perform at least once.
Yeah, we get reintroduced to characters from the first movie.
Yeah, Fats Domino performs at one point.
Sure.
This is like, it's the movie just goes into musical numbers at times, and like that used to be more common, that a movie would just have a musical number
in
it.
Fats Domino being definitely the biggest name of all the
oh, sure.
The first half of the movie features multiple like lengthy performances.
In this, and it's something that I wish they'd done better, because I would have kind of liked it if they did it better. That there's something about country music that I don't always like listening to like on my headphones, but in a movie I'm more than willing to have a scene where it's just a band performing, you know.
Yeah.
There's something about country music that like I like more in a movie, the same way that like techno music works for me when it's in the soundtrack of a movie, but I would never listen to it.
When vampires are fighting Blade or something.
It sounds terrible, yeah.
But by and large, these are not great country bands.
No, they're not. They couldn't really get out the big names. Fats Domino is the biggest.
They're in honky tonks.
The fact that Fats Domino is the biggest name in the country music movie is says something. But anyway, eventually, we see some slick New York types who watch a mongoose fight a snake, and they start talking about this fighter named Wilson, who apparently is so tough he's been hurting people, and no one will fight him. But then they hear about Phil Beddo, the fight king of the West, played by Clint Eastwood, and they say, if we can get these two guys to fight, it'll be the fight of the century. These two famous bare-knuckle underground fighters. And so they approach Clint Eastwood, and they offer him money to fight this guy Wilson. The characters kind of hang around again for a while. We see Clyde literally just hang around the yard punching things.
Despite being grifted by Sandra Locke, they end up getting together.
Yeah, he breaks her out of a YWCA. The first third of the movie
is that, right?
We shouldn't pass over the scene where after he breaks her out of the YWCA, they like go out into, I guess, the shed.
Yeah, like, this is what I want to get to. So she's going to stay over at his house.
Sure.
Sleeping in his room, which has a huge gun case. This case just full of rifles. But anyway, she says,
real American.
Where are you going to sleep? And he goes, I'll sleep in the shed with Clyde. And he beds down with
Clyde.
Which
has gotten much larger, I think, than in the first film.
Yeah. They expanded it with the money they made in the first film.
So Clyde is spooning him in this. Clyde. They're swaddled together.
They spoon. Sandra Locke walks in and is like, basically, is there room for one more? Gets into bed with Clint and Clyde. Fade to black.
Yeah, Clyde does not leave.
No, Clyde puts his hand over her hand.
And this is a shed with straw all over the ground, and Clint clearly took his shirt off before getting in bed with an orangutan, which is probably a scratchy animal.
Scratchy, but also, like, Clyde has clearly peed and shat all over the shed. That's why that's why the straw is there.
Yep, and he put a newspaper clipping of an orangutan he wants to bang on the wall.
The straw is not there so Clyde can spit it into gold after selling his first child to Rumpelstiltskin. It's there because it's absorbing pee. And on the wall is an article that I guess Clyde ripped out of the newspaper of an orangutan at the zoo.
He combs the fucking newspaper looking for orangutan stories.
Well, he has a clipping
service.
And he
finally found one.
He has a clipping service that cuts orangutan stories for him. And this one is a girl orangutan that he has a crush on, and he's put it up as a pin-up in his room. But anyway, so we fade to the next morning. Clint Eastwood and Sandra Locke are just in bed with Clyde. Clyde gets up, so leaves the two lovebirds, and
after
just
kissing her on the face.
And I know he's not a monkey, but he is just monkeying around in the yard for a while.
Yeah, but we have to assume that alighted in that. Was a threesome.
A threesome between Clint Eastwood and orangutan and Sandra Locke.
Well,
yeah.
And after Clyde leaves, they make joke. They make a comment about, like, okay, he's gone. We can, we can get it on, I guess. They didn't say it in so many words. And then they cut to a shot of Clyde, like, goofing around, breaking shit. And you're assuming that's a visual metaphor for intercourse, right?
There's no more poetic parallel for human intercourse than an orangutan in a junkyard just wrecking stuff.
Spraying water into his mouth from a hose.
When he's wiggling his body into a trash can. That's what.
And he gets wrapped up in a hammock.
Dan, let me talk to you about the birds and bees.
What?
That's basically what it's like.
My dad sat me down when I was young and he said, son, I want you to hear this from me. I want to tell you about the orangutans and the trash cans. When an orangutan
always
loves a trash
can.
Always. You're going to want to put a hammock on that thing before you get in a trash can. Safe sex, hon. Safe sex. And that's why I've never had sex, because it scared the hell out of me. So thanks, Dad.
Sounded gross.
Disgusting. So anyway, Clint Eastwood has a threesome with orangutan and a lady. And he decides, I guess, that he doesn't want to fight.
Why would you want to fight somebody after that moment?
Yeah, and he pisses off the mob guys. And the mob guy says, we'll be back. But I skipped over the sequence in which, or maybe it happens after this, the sequence where they're going to get Clyde a date with that orangutan he has a crush on. Mm-hmm. So they go to the zoo.
That's later.
Yeah,
that's after he pisses off the mobsters, and then Clyde rips apart the guy's
Cadillac. That's okay. So Clyde he says, I don't want to fight, and the mobster says, you're gonna fight, and if you don't, my friends are gonna come see you. And he's like, okay, send your friends. Clyde, rip apart his car.
Yeah,
so he does.
Which comes after an earlier scene where we see Clyde helping Orville in Orville's junkyard business rip apart a junk car.
Now that's Chekhov once said,
yeah,
if an orangutan rips apart a car in the first act, we have to see the orangutan rip apart a mobster's car in the second act.
But each of these scenes are like 5 minutes of this primate.
Look, you got this movie is almost 2 hours long. You got to pad it out. So let's see the orangutan pick up every piece of the car.
And then have an insert shot
of it flying
through
the air.
Someone throwing a piece of metal through the air.
It's like the shot in Lady Hawk when they shoot down the hawk with an arrow, and it clearly looks like somebody just stuck a hawk with an arrow and threw it in the air.
It's the shot at the end of Rookie of the Year when the guy hits a the ball really high, and you can clearly see a hand at the bottom of the frame throwing the ball up in the air.
I was going to say, it's like the shot at the end of Goonies where he tears up the contract and throws it up in the air, and then you see other pieces of confetti come in from the other sides as like two other people from each side throw in more torn up paper.
Now, another thing we should mention, there's a biker gang that Clint pissed off in the first movie called the Black Widows. Mm-hmm. They are a neo-Nazi gang, but they're pretty incompetent and bumbling, so they're kind of lovable.
Yeah, they're like Hogan's Heroes style.
I guess it's like if you mixed Hogan's Heroes and Sons of Anarchy, that's basically what these guys are. And they... First, Clyde punches them and they fall down. Mm-hmm. Another time, they get chased through a tar factory, I guess?
Yep.
And they got hot tar on them, and Clint takes them to the hospital. And that's hot tar can kill people. It's really dangerous, but all that happens is their hair gets ripped off. So they're wearing crazy wigs.
They're frozen into statue shapes.
Yeah, but then the hospital, they take the tar off.
Oh, okay.
The dinosaurs were just frozen into statue shapes.
Oh, I wish. Man, if we could just...
a bunch of statue dinosaurs.
Yep.
Yep.
That's why there's all those dinosaur statues.
That's why the dinosaurs are bald.
And they wear funny clown wigs. Dinosaur clown wigs.
Spoiler alert, those guys after they lose their
Jurassic
hair
Park get funny clown wigs. Jurassic Park 4 funny clown wigs. We mixed the DNA of the dinosaurs with the DNA of funny clown wigs.
So this is a gang of
we hope nothing bad happens, and then the dinosaurs don't get loose, but no one wants to see these dinosaurs with crazy clown hair.
The dinosaurs are dangerously hilarious.
The children are too afraid of the dinosaurs, no, of the clowns. We never should have mixed them with clown DNA. Watch this. And he just pokes a dinosaur and you hear, they're not supposed to make that noise. We're going to have to, we'll fit all the dinosaurs into one car. Take them on tour around the country. Make the clown DNA work for us.
Yeah. $1 million idea.
Well, I don't know.
Maybe half a million.
I think the audience would pay $1 million to not have heard that whole thing. Anyway, so... Clint Eastwood's going to have to do this fight. We'll find out later why, but he's pissed off the mob. And the important thing to know, though, is Clyde's got to get laid. Mm-hmm, so they go to the zoo.
Clyde got to have it.
Clyde was originally cast in She's Got to Have It until Spike Lee decided, you know what, let me make this about contemporary Brooklyn life and not about an orangutan who's really horny.
Yeah.
Anyway, so they go to the zoo, and this is where it gets morally dubious. This is where the pit-fighting movie about a guy who keeps an orangutan in a shed and has sex with it becomes morally dubious, in that they go to the zoo with a vial of some kind of sedative.
Yeah, where do you get that sedative from?
From the vet, I guess.
Okay. A mail-order
orangutan sedative company. Yeah, who knows? Clint Eastwood was mixing it up in a vat in his backyard.
Back then, you didn't have the internet. You had to order it from the back of the comic books.
That was
books.
Back when you could buy guns and orangutan medicine from the back of comic books.
I feel
books.
Like this is a movie where the appearance of anything incongruous can be explained by that he just fought a guy for it.
Okay, I can see that.
Yeah.
Like, where did this gang get these great wigs? Oh, they fought some guy for it,
and so, yeah, and that's a good point. Okay. Where did Clyde get that... thing?
What the newspaper clipping?
Yeah, the newspaper clipping. Yeah.
He fought his clipping service. Yeah, he fought and he won a year's supply of clipping service.
You sure you just want orangutan news? You got a year's supply. Go crazy. No, just the orangutans.
Just give me hot orangutans. I lost my subscription to PlayChimp. Anyway, so they go to the zoo. Clyde somehow they have a syringe of orangutan sedative and a banana, and Clyde sticks himself with the syringe and passes out. So Clint's like, I guess it's up to me. Hope I find the right tan. And
which we don't know if he did.
He brings her back, and Clyde's all over. Which leads to they go to a motel, and this is when Clint and Sandra Locke are in one room. Uh-huh. Clyde and his date are in another room. Anne Ramsey and her husband.
Anne Ramsey, you may remember from Throw Mama from the Train.
Eponymous the titular
Mama.
Earlier in the movie, she and her husband were seen driving down the highway, and they saw Clint Orville and Clyde peeing on the side of the road. It was a hilarious gag. Now those characters come back, and the orangutans are making so much noise that they want to leave, but she gets up to pack the suitcase, and the sight of her butt as she bends over the suitcase and the sound of orangutans doing it drives her husband wild with lust, and so they
have recalls some kind of like past life experience he had of some
of a hula dancer. Meanwhile, well, so there's
like flat, like there's, you hear some jungle drums on the soundtrack. It's very disturbing.
It's all, this is one of a couple times in the movie that it gets really goofy, and the next time is about to come up too. So the mob bad guys.
But wait, hold on. Let's not gloss over the fact. You mentioned it before, but let's underline this. Clint Eastwood has kidnapped an orangutan
so that his orangutan, can have sex with it.
Basically sexually assault this monkey.
The woman, well, here's the thing. The female orangutan.
She seems into it.
She's lying in bed. She seems into it. Meanwhile, Clyde's just wasting his time.
What would she look like if she was not into it?
I assume she'd like have her mace out.
She'd say no. What, like a mace, like a cudgel?
Yeah, like a ball and chain, like a morning star. Yeah. The just a medieval ape swinging a morning star. How scary would that have been?
What a great idea! An idea of a knight who rides around with an orangutan on a horse.
It's a mysterious knight who never speaks, and it turns out he's an orangutan.
Okay, I like it.
But he's noble at heart. He fights a dragon. It turns out the dragon is just a big dog.
Sure.
But this love.
And they save the king of England, who turns out to be a pigeon with a bottle cap on his head that looks like a crown. I call it Elliot's fairy tale animals.
But this love interlude with Clint and Sandra.
I have finished the love interlude. It's interrupted. This is a long scene. It goes on
at least 15 minutes.
And Clyde is impressing his date by picking up the furniture and throwing it and hanging from the chandelier. Clint impresses Sandra Locke by also hanging from the chandelier. Okay,
shirtless, wearing jeans.
Meanwhile, a bunch of mobsters with guns and three-piece suits, because it's the 70s, they go to Ruth Gordon's house and Orville's house, and they say, where's Philo? Mm-hmm. They basically threaten them into telling them where they are, and then they go to try to stop them. Ruth Gordon goes, oh, no, I got to save them, I guess. Jumps in a tow truck, drives away. Orville gets in his car and drives away.
They drive past miles and miles of auto body shops.
Yeah. This is in this movie, every store is an auto body shop. Occasionally there's a fast food restaurant, but it's kind of like in Cannonball Run, the entire country is just roads and cars. Like in this one, it's just roads and repair shops.
Having grown up in the Midwest, that is not entirely inaccurate.
This movie doesn't take place in the Midwest. They're going to Bakersfield, California.
I'm just saying the great center of this land of ours. Is a vast,
and I repeat again, emptiness. That's not where the movie takes place.
Yeah, all right.
That's like if the movie is set in New York and it's nothing but ice Dairy Queens, and you're like, hey, in the Midwest, there's a lot of Dairy Queens. Well, not that many in New York, and you're certainly there's other businesses.
Once you get out of the city in California,
broaden your horizons is what we're saying.
I guess you're telling me to go to the boring parts of the country.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Stop wasting my time in the vibrant metropolises.
Yep,
metropolises.
I don't know. Ask Superman.
Okay. Point is, Ruth Gordon.
Ruth Gordon goes to the motel.
Tracks them down the motel
to warn Clint Eastwood.
She sees the hotel proprietor who's peeping in on the people having sex.
One of the sex couples. It could be the orangutans. Because I mean, frankly, if you were passing by a motel, you saw orangutans having sex in the window, you would stop and watch.
The point is,
don't lie to me, Dan. Tell me the truth. You would stop and watch.
Certainly I would. But the point
is,
and you know how long you would watch until were finished.
Completion.
No, yeah, exactly. You would watch the afterglow and the cuddling for a while just to make sure they didn't start up again. Because you're a perv.
But the sound of
you're the only guy I know goes to the zoo and then yells like, come on, go at it. I paid my $7.
The sound of orangutans.
Disgusting.
Having
$7? That's a small zoo.
It's a very small zoo, and they only have turtles.
Sure. No orangutans at all. What am I shouting at?
He's shouting at the turtles. And if any birds happen to be flying by, hey, bird, come on down and have sex with this turtle.
Turtles having sex is very slow, which makes it all the sexier. It's all tantric.
It's more sensual, yeah. When Sting says, I do tantric sex and I can have sex for hours. The turtle's like, and?
But what I wanted to say, the sound of the orangutans having sex has whipped this entire hotel complex into an erotic frenzy.
And so Ruth Gordon sees this guy peeping, and he is suddenly totally turned on by Ruth Gordon. And this is the other goofy moment, is he visualizes Bo Derek in 10 running down the beach, but with Ruth Gordon's face superimposed over Bo Derek.
Yeah, we're talking about modern day level special effects.
This is
effects.
Like a Steve Odekirk movie level joke and effect. In a way that, I wish this movie had more of it, because when this movie is best, and by best I mean tolerable, is when it goes totally off the rails. But anyway, he goes, "How about it?" to Ruth Gordon, who kicks him in the nuts, and then immediately is like, "Oh no, the only live one in 20 years, and I ruin him." And then she comes on to him, and it's implied they have sex also. Yeah. So
everyone, Orville, is sexually satisfied.
Orville goes, he knows the mob is coming, so what he does is he goes to a fast food restaurant where he sees some cops, yells at them that they're gay, they get mad and chase him to the motel, it breaks up, and the mob guys run away when they hear the sirens. He saved Clint Eastwood, but at what cost? Now he's in jail, and they think he's a homophobe.
Yeah, he's a labeled homophobe.
Yeah. Now he's going to get
kicked out.
He's going
to be on a watch list.
He's no longer going to be the CEO of Mozilla. He has to sell his share in the LA Clippers.
That's right.
Orville's whole business is falling apart.
Yeah.
So after that, they go to return this orangutan they kidnapped to the zoo. And while they're there, the mob guys come. They kidnap Sandra Locke. They beat up Clint Eastwood, and they light his truck on fire. Clyde saves him by dragging him across a parking lot.
Dragging him like 2 feet away from where he was originally.
So he's still singed, probably.
Yeah.
And Clint Eastwood and Orville are like, "We got to get her back."
Yeah.
But after spending some time working on fucking car parts,
he's working on an engine. Repair his truck.
Doesn't seem that concerned. Easy come, easy go.
He's repairing his truck and he gets a call from the mob that's like, "You going to try to rescue your girlfriend?"
Oh, yeah. I had a girlfriend.
I forgot about that. Clyde and I have moved on. Please tell her to let it go. I'm a one orangutan man. And they say,
"Too complex before.
You have to do this fight or else we're going to kill her, I guess." And the fight's going to be in Jackson Hole, Wyoming.
That's a good vacation.
I apologize.
We skipped a very important scene,
which is why he said he wasn't going to do the fight, which is that the other fighter, Wilson, just shows up one day and starts jogging with Clint Eastwood, and they really get along and hit it off as friends.
Yeah, they have a lot in common. They Wilson like punching people.
Falls off a cliff, and Clint Eastwood saves him. And so, they are buddies now, and they don't want to fight.
It's like
and
moving then, the thorn Wilson, from the line.
And it's one of those things where it's like, they've been talking about this Wilson guy as if he is a monster. He's been hurting people. No one will fight him. And when he shows up, he is the most good-natured, well-mannered man. Mm-hmm. He's super friendly. Everybody loves him. He should be the hero of the movie. If anything, Clint Eastwood is the villain of this movie. He is enslaved an orangutan. He kidnaps another orangutan. He infiltrates a YWCA and breaks the rules there. He's living off the largesse of Ruth Gordon. Mm-hmm. He is the bad guy, and this guy monster. Wilson is a real stand-up noble act. You know?
He's got his business is based around beating people up. I mean, people. So is
the hero of the movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, I feel like
his business was based around beating people up? Superman.
Oh, nice. How'd that pay for him?
Very well. Because what would happen was he would set it up with the bad guys. They would pay him to come defeat them. And then he would steal some of the money and give it to him.
That's pretty meta. That sounds a current DC book.
Let's say you're robbing a bank. Superman comes and, quote, stops you. Uh-huh. Really, at super speed, he takes some of the money.
He wants to wet his beak a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. Also, Superman has a beak in these stories because it's one of those imaginary stories where a witch put a spell on him and he has a bird head.
I thought that was the bad guy, the evil version of Thor that's
Beta Ray Bill?
Yeah, Beta
he's
Ray Bill.
Evil.
He's also a good guy.
No, he's got a horse face.
All right, I think we need to fast forward a little bit.
To Jackson Hole.
Wilson helps him rescue Sandra Locke.
Wilson helps him rescue Sandra Locke. Orville gets shot during the rescue attempt, which the brilliant plan involves Orville jumping out from behind a corner on top of a guy.
Yeah.
And then they punch each other for a while.
He jumps on top of her and then they just the guy shoot. Got shot.
Oh, that's right. Well, they don't want to fight, but then they're like, and there's all this money that was bet on the fight. People are coming from all over the country to bet on this fight.
Even Northern Exposure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Barry Corbin comes all the way
Barry
from Northern
Corbin.
Exposure.
I prefer to think of him as War Games is Barry Corbin. Yeah. And his Barry Corbin, and he is the best character in the whole movie, aside from Wilson, the bad guy who's really a good guy. Barry Corbin is one of three, I guess, rich cowboys who just travel the country having the same strip poker game with their three girlfriends and flying a plane upside down. They seem to have the most fun life in the world. But everyone goes to Jackson Hole. The Black Widows go and they bet on Phil. These two old ladies go and they bet on Phil. Everyone wants to see this fight happen. And Phil and Wilson say, "You know what? We're not going to fight. We're friends." And then they're like, "Hey, you know what? But I do wonder who would have won that fight, you or me. So they go to an abandoned barn in the middle of, like a repair shack somewhere, a barn, mm-hmm. and they just start punching each other. Some kids see them doing it. The police see the kids. Word gets out. The fight is on. The entire town runs over like they're running away from a giant spider or something, just running down the street to go watch this fight. And it's like a shitty version of The Quiet Man. Clint Eastwood and this guy Wilson just punching each other all around town.
Yeah, like bursting through walls, doing like stage transitions.
They burst through the window of an Italian restaurant. They're in a mall.
What are those people doing sitting around eating Italian food? They should be watching this awesome fight.
And much like in Gangster Squad, it ends up in a public park where, long story short, Clint Eastwood gets his arm broken by Wilson, and Wilson says, "That's it, the fight's over. I broke your arm." And Clint's like, "No, I'm not done yet." They keep fighting. He manages to knock Wilson out. The guys who were the bookies who arranged the whole thing and now are out all this money because everyone, I guess, bet on the winner, which makes me feel bad for Wilson that apparently nobody bet on him.
He's such a nice guy, and he's totally ripped.
They try to run out of town, but the Black Widows stop them and take all the money. The Black Widows are totally made up with Clint by this point.
Mm-hmm.
They realize he's a great fighter and he's not that bad a guy, and now they're rich. And Clint Eastwood goes home.
Yeah, he basically leaves. He gets stopped on the way out of town by a motorcycle cop, but Clyde punches him, so everything's okay.
It's like the end of Stoker.
Any which way you can. Yep, it's just like the end of Stoker. It's slightly less fatal than the end of Stoker.
I don't know. He hit that cop pretty hard. You don't see him get up.
That's true. He's knocked out in the middle of the desert. He'll probably die of heat, heat stroke or dehydration.
Coyote consumption.
Just a coyote. It's just like Gangster Squad again. A coyote's going to come along and eat him.
Sure.
So here's, you know what? There's so much to say that's bad about this movie and the loose plot and it's stupid. Let me tell you one thing I liked about it.
Okay. Just one thing.
There's a lot of handheld camera work in the fight scenes and the scenes where Clyde is just monkeying around. Oh, I thought we were... Never mind. We banned that pun, but I'm saying anyway. You know, I'll pay my fine later. Was it like
sure.
10 monkey yeah. bucks or something?
It'd be $8.
And I really like how... I really liked that. Like the use of handheld cameras in those scenes.
I guess.
And
although,
that's the one thing I liked.
Although when they're fighting, the thing I didn't like about this movie, one of the things I didn't like about this movie is for a movie based on, in part, on bare knuckle fighting, all of the fight scenes just consisted of Clint Eastwood punching at the camera.
And then it would cut to a guy whoa, 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 falling backwards. The fights are
no choreography.
Terribly choreographed.
Okay, so things I liked. Okay. I liked every time the Black Widow showed up, we got a little bit of doo-wop or a little bit of jazz saxophone.
For some reason, these neo-Nazi bikers and 50s doo-wop, they're bikers, they listen to doo-wop,
yeah,
I guess,
they're
right?
Tough guys.
The Gorch.
I like that first fight in the quarry when Clint Eastwood knocks that guy down, and then there's two babes just bouncing up and down.
Okay, that was a moment where there's two busty babes jumping up and down, and I was like, I like this. Let's see more of them. And then the camera literally zooms in on one of their on a set of boobs, and I was like, all right, now I feel kind of gross.
Yeah, they make you feel like a voyeur.
You know what?
That was a film critiquing your male gaze.
That
Elliot.
Scene, that
yeah, that's
that
funny
moment,
games all over again.
That moment accomplished what Sucker Punch failed to do in 2 hours,
sure.
which was make me identify my lust and then feel bad for it, for objectifying these women. Zack Snyder, you should watch any which way you can and realize how a master does it. And that master is whoever directed this.
Buddy Van Horn, I believe.
Buddy Van Horn.
Yeah.
Of the Deadpool.
And of other movies. He made some movies with Clint Eastwood.
Guys.
Well, I'm going to say another thing.
Okay.
This movie is, as you said, we're watching it, rich with incident. And I've discovered the difference between a movie like this and a movie like Killer of Sheep, which is also just incident, but which is a rich picture of the life of a community. And that is quality. So I guess that's the difference.
What kind of movie is this? Was this a comedy or was it an action movie?
I mean, I think it's categorized under adventure comedy.
Adventure comedy,
which is a pretty loose 70s
Jewels
style.
Of the Nile and your
people swinging
romancing
from
the stone.
Your Romancings of the Stone and your Straw Dogs is.
All right.
I guess it's not really a comedy or an adventure.
I feel like this has
your Ghostbusters is.
Yeah,
this is one of those. This feels like a very 70s movie. There's a lot of scenes that are a little too long, like crane shots that go on just a little too long.
Yeah.
All shots went on too long.
Everything in the movie is very slow-paced. And I'm a guy who is fine with a slow-paced movie if it makes sense. This did not. a wacky comedy about an orangutan and a fist fighter should not be a slow-paced movie.
And the orangutan is, of course, an afterthought.
The orangutan is totally superfluous to almost everything in the movie except the kidnapping another orangutan for sex subplot. Although that was like, it was like
which
the screenwriters.
Was the best subplot.
It's like the screenwriters were like, we gotta have a reason to explore for this for Clyde to still be in the movie. We have to come up with a reason why this movie can't start with Clint Eastwood looking down at a tombstone that says Clyde on it. So let's put this subplot in. But otherwise, he doesn't factor into the final fight. He doesn't factor into any of the scenes where they like get away with stuff, except I guess when that mob guy's car gets ripped off. Ripped up, like, if he's just a hindrance and he never helps them in any way.
Yeah. All right, we got to tie a bow on this, so let's go to final judgments. Is this a good, bad movie, a bad, bad movie, or a movie you kind of like? Elliot, what do you have to say about that?
I wish I could have said it was a movie I kind of liked, but I'm going to have to say a bad, bad movie.
Yeah.
It was almost a good, it had the potential to be a good, bad movie.
I would say that for me, the first half of this movie was a bad, bad movie. The second half was a good bad movie.
If it was all like the second half, but you got to slog through the first half to get the second half.
Do.
Yeah, as soon as they kidnap that that poor orangutan, it becomes a good bad movie, I think. But up until that point, no.
So if you're making a movie and the movie is slowing down, have the characters kidnap an orangutan for sex.
Yeah. I mean, not necessarily for them to have sex with it.
No, for them, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, if you're making a
Like the filmmakers?
If you were making like if you're making a biography of Charles Lindbergh and it's starting to drag, have Lindbergh kidnap an orangutan and have sex with it. Yeah, I guarantee you it'll shoot some energy into the movie.
Before we move on, we have a few words from sponsors. Stu, I believe you had a few words first up.
So, guys, listeners at home, you love your mom, right? Of course you do. And
if you didn't, you'd be a monster.
And you're terrible. So coming in a couple of weeks, we got Mother's Day, or a week and a half, or a week from the airing of this episode. And thanks to the Flophouse, you now can get a little deal on on some flowers for that mother in your life.
Fleur de Mer.
Why don't you surprise her with a beautiful 100 blooms bouquet plus a free glass vase from proflowers.com for just $19.99. Did you hear that, Elliot?
$19.95 for flowers and a vase?
You probably have that in your wallet right now.
So I should pay cash, is what you're saying?
Yeah, just feed into the disk drive.
Give it to me and I'll send it to ProFlowers.
And you can upgrade to 100 blooms with a pink vase and chocolates for only $9.99 more. That's only roughly $29.99. That's a pretty good deal. Now, what you need to do is use the code FLOPHOUSE to get this special price on your Mother's Day order while supplies last. So you just go over to proflowers.com.
Proflowers.clown.
So go to proflowers.com. On the upper right-hand corner is a blue microphone, and you need to click on that thing. There will be a little text line, and you type in Flophouse.
The name of your favorite podcast.
Yep, the name of your favorite Flophouse is The Flophouse. It's a podcast. And that deal expires Friday at midnight, so don't drag your feet, guys.
Friday before Mother's Day.
Yes, that's the Friday before Mother's Day at midnight. So don't drag your feet. Get your mom some flowers.
And also, we have another sponsor for this episode. It is one Warby Parker, a new concept in eyewear. Look, guys, if you can't see, you can't see. That's a terrible thing. But you shouldn't have to pay out the nose for that, right?
So this is a service for blind people?
Well, it's for people like me who've got not 20/20 vision. And
I believe I have 20/2000 vision.
People who think that glasses should not be a pretty penny. And Warby Parker's prescription glasses start at $95, including the prescription lenses. And the titanium collection starts at a mere $145, including prescription lenses. And all glasses include anti-reflective and anti-glare coating at no additional cost. But the real advantage of Warby Parker is you can buy your glasses online with the Home Try-On program, which allows customers to order 5 pairs of glasses to be shipped directly to them, where they can try them on in the comfort of their own home and get feedback from, say, your wife, the person who has to stare at your mug, or your husband.
someone that you want to impress.
Who also has to stare at your mug.
Yeah.
Or your mug collection. Maybe your mugs want to stare at you for once.
It's only fair.
You've been staring at them.
You can keep those frames for 5 days before sending them back free with the prepaid returning shipping label with no obligation to buy. And when you place an order, Warby Parker will get started on that order right away and have your new glasses in your hands within 10 business days or even faster than that. And even better, for every pair of glasses sold, Warby Parker will distribute a pair of glasses to someone in need. You can also get prescription polarized sunglasses or non-prescription polarized sunglasses. If you want to take advantage of this offer, go over to warbyparker.com and use the code Flophouse. Now,
use the code Flophouse whenever you buy anything.
Yeah.
But especially Pro Flowers.
If a thing asks you for a code, try using Flophouse.
Try using Flophouse, especially if it's Pro Flowers, which you should buy, and Warby Parker, which you also buy.
I, in fact, am wearing Warby Parker glasses at this moment.
And you look amazing. Way better than you should.
Yeah. I'm usually kind of a dopey-looking fellow.
Mm-hmm.
But now, I'm like Clark Kent.
Is this some kind of James Dean character?
Yeah.
With glasses?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he'd look good with glasses.
Right? He would look good with glasses.
So, but now, let's move on a little bit to a little all things comedy specific plugging. Take a look at Eddie Pepitone's podcast, Pep Talks, a comedic look at the crumbling of our world. Eddie guides us into the apocalypse every Thursday with guest comedians, and check him out at Eddie Pepitone on Twitter.
Iconic comedian Eddie Pepitone,
mm-hmm. A cranky but hilarious fellow. And for our personal plug, on May the 10th in Yonkers, New
personal
York.
Personal plug.
We will be doing a live show at the Alamo Draft House at 7:30 p.m. That's May the 10th.
7:30.
At 7:30 p.m.
P.M.
Please show up early as
the Alamo Draft House Yonkers.
Sleepwalkers.
Yeah. The Draft House is tough on latecomers, so show up before
early.
That 7:30
no
p.m.
No texting.
Time.
Come by 7:15 for best results.
No talking during the movie.
Except from us.
Yeah, we'll be screening.
Sorry.
Stephen King's Sleepwalkers.
Stephen King.
Mick Garris.
And we'll have an intro by our friends at I Love Bad Movies. And running commentary
friends.
From us.
Us.
Running.
Comment, airy.
Yeah.
All laughs aside, guys. I'm looking forward to doing this show.
Me too. It's going to be a really fun show. We haven't done a live show in a long time. And I don't know when we're doing another one anytime soon. So get the self to Yonkers.
Yeah, with this guy.
Just in time for Mother's Day.
Nailed down with his beautiful little bundle of joy.
Yep.
I'm pretty happy with my kitten, Dan. That's what you were talking about. Uh-huh.
That's what Dan was talking
Muscles
about.
Muscles is pretty adorable. But moving on. To letters from listeners.
Oh, our favorite part of the podcast.
It is, and here's my favorite part of the favorite part of the podcast.
What's that?
Letters. Letters, get out of your fetters.
He just kind of stares at me in the
distance
when
he starts. Everything's about to get betters for the letters. As Dan frees them from the letter prison, he keeps them in.
State.
Dan's a cruel letter warden.
Like
Dan keeps the letters in the prison all the time. That's solitary for you. Solitary for you, too.
That's
making the female letters have pillow fights all the time and take showers. Dan's a corrupt letter warden. Free them from the letter prison, Dan.
It's always darkest before
free
the
dawn. Letter prison so we can read them and reply to them. Get out of that letter prison.
Thanks, Elliot. For this first letter, it's titled...
That was kind of short.
Castle Freak
Just
Interrupted.
Like
Castle Freak Interrupted.
I think I can handle this one, guys.
Stewart's word. Somebody tells me the phrase ding-dong is going to be used.
It's from Cody, last name withheld.
Oh, the guy from Step by Step.
Yeah. Greetings, floppers. After multiple recommendations from Stuart, I, at long last, fired up the internet and took in a showing of Castle Freak at my local video streaming service. Thinking it a justifiable precaution, I did so while my wife was still at work.
That's the full moon streaming, I would hope.
Cosmic vibes aligned such that she managed to return home just as Jeffrey Combs was nose deep in a prostitute. Thankfully, I still had my pants on. So the explanation, I heard about it on a podcast, somehow satisfied her curiosity about why I was watching this on a weekday afternoon. I have a great wife.
Not long. It's part of the Disney afternoon, I swear. A Gummy Bears was just on. Tailspin's about to be on.
This is the Wuzzles.
That was a Saturday morning show.
Okay. Not...
not too Dan.
Thanks for fact-checking me.
Well, if it's about Wuzzles, I'm going to fact-check.
All right. Not too long after this...
There was a half lion, half bee, and a half elephant, half... What, kangaroo?
Yeah, so...
Elaroo, and his name was?
The last part refers to animals, but what does the was part mean?
Because, like...
They was animals.
Yeah, it checks out.
Was part refers to how it was profitable for the toy company.
So
Castle Freak. He's watching it. His wife walks in. Honey, it's not what it looks like. This isn't a freak who lives in a castle.
Not too long after this, the two of us decided to take in Reanimator, which she had not yet seen. Sure. I mentioned to my wife that Stuart Gordon...
Date night, I guess.
I mentioned to my wife, Stuart Gordon, the auteur behind Castle Freak, directed this picture as well. Then, as Dr. Hill's severed head zeroed in on Barbara Crampton's nethers, my wife exclaimed, "What? What's the deal with this guy in muff diving?" She did enjoy Reanimator, but now Stuart Gordon will forever be the director that loves muff diving to her. About a week later, my wife spent the evening with a few friends of hers, one of whom had brought a new girlfriend along. In the course of conversation, this mysterious girlfriend revealed that she was in fact the niece of Stuart Gordon, and shockingly, not proud of that.
Oh, that's too bad.
Unfortunately, thanks to recent mental associations, she couldn't maintain eye contact long enough to ask any probing questions. What Gordon-related encounters will the universe direct our way in the near future? Clearly, we've established some sort of karmic link. I'll keep you posted. Cordially yours, Cody, last name withheld.
Wow, we got some celeb sightings.
Yeah, well, I kind of celeb niece sightings.
Well, I will write down all my questions in a letter and mail them off to you. So you can ask the niece of Stuart Gordon, like, when is the Dolls franchise going to continue?
What's Dagon like in real life?
Sure.
Dagon, did he say?
Yeah.
Like Dagon, the painter?
What would you say?
Dagon. No, Dagon. Right. Dagon.
Right. He's at like Dagon.
Yeah, that's if he was trying to be fancy.
I see.
This next letter.
He was a deep one. He was putting on airs.
Sure.
I got to impress Nardole Thotep. Make him think I'm educated.
This next letter is from Stacy, last name withheld. She says,
Stacy Keebler.
Hello, boys. I hope all is well with you at the Flophouse. I would like you to know that you have officially invaded my brain. I had a dream last night with you in it. Actually, Elliot was mysteriously missing for some reason.
Couldn't handle it. Well, not everyone's ready for this jelly.
But Dan and Stuart were there. Mostly Dan, though. I won't get into details, but it involved me being in a super pretentious hipster bar in Brooklyn.
Sounds like a stress dream.
That was playing videos of Stuart dancing and singing in a tiny Speedo on the beach.
Okay, that's possible.
Dan apparently moving out of his apartment, and at one point, Dan walking into my house naked. Needless to say, I greeted him with, "Looking good, Dan."
Even though he was not looking good. But he seemed so depressed, I was worried he would kill himself if I revealed how horrible he looked.
I will leave all the parts in between up to your imagination, but I will tell you that when Dan was moving out of his apartment, he was for some reason just carrying all of his possessions from one place to the next on foot and dropping a lot of it in between. I ended up walking behind him and picking up his bowling ball and size 15 worn down old man slippers for him. So bizarre. Anywho, just wanted to say hi and keep on flopping.
Were you still naked at that point?
Yeah, that's what I want to know.
I guess.
All my clothes have been packed.
Sure.
You guys are awesome and the only thing I enjoy about my commute to work, and you make me laugh out loud every day. Keep up the good work. And Dan, keep up that bod. XOXO, Stacy.
Thanks for writing in, Stacy, and not letting me into your weird moving / sex dream.
And thank you for imagining me so apparently...
willing to walk downwind of you while you drop bowling balls and whatnot.
Sure.
Downwind. Because he's an animal, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So...
Well, that was a very flattering letter, Dan. How does that make you feel?
So did you write that?
I did not write that, no.
Or should I say Stacy?
Comes in that has anything complimentary about me that you assume.
You must be on top of the world with these new glasses, letters about your bod. Where's the letter bag going to take us next? That's what we call it, right? A letter bag?
Yep. Letter sack.
Yeah.
So this last letter.
Reach deep into the letter bag and pull out a choice gem.
This last letter.
Dust off that gem and read it out loud.
Polish it nicely.
Okay.
For the resale. Use a steam. Use a steam thing. Okay, now it's some kind of like steel wool, I guess.
You're wearing chainmail. You're orcs in chainmail.
Okay, now it's a creaky door. There's a witch behind it. And a bubbling cauldron.
Wait,
we can't hear that.
That sounds gross.
And that's not the right sound.
It was like a Stuart Gordon movie.
Here's the sound it would make. Bubble. Bubbling. Bubble. All
right. Well, this last letter is from David, last name withheld.
Oh, God. This better not be.
Elliot's brother.
Oh, why? It's so late.
It's titled, Harold and Me. Dear Flopcasters, my heart was
warmed. Wait, so is he Maud?
My heart was warmed while listening to the Olympus Has Fallen episode when Elliot regaled listeners with the epic tale of our first brush with fame at the world premiere of Multiplicity.
I think it was a New York premiere. I don't know if it was a world premiere.
However, in listening to Elliot's
they
version...
They probably held the world premiere in like Tokyo or something.
In listening to Elliot's version of the events, I feel there were some important disparities or clarifying details left out. Well, thank goodness I'm here to fix that, right?
Nope.
So since you asked, here we go. First of all, the reason we had tickets to Multiplicity was not simply because our father's connection to the president of Columbia TriStar, and yes, they were in fact college roommates, but because it was a consolation prize to the family after we'd been told we could visit the set of the Brad Pitt Harrison Ford action film, The Devil's Own.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Which was scheduled to be filming scenes at Christ Church in Short Hills, New Jersey. At the last minute, however, filming for The Devil's Own was moved from the church, and so we're given tickets to Multiplicity to make up for disappointment. As for my lifelong friendship with Harold Ramis, or as I knew him, Harry, that was actually started by Ramis as we walked out of the Ziegfeld Theater where the premiere had been held, and Ramis asked me what I thought of the movie. I told him it was pretty good, and he laughed and walked away, at which point my father said to me, "Do you know who that was, Dave? It was Egon." Despite being a huge Ghostbusters fan at the time, I was also 10 years old, and therefore did not realize I had been speaking with the great Egon Spengler.
He probably thought Egon was a real person who was busy ghostbusting.
Yeah,
sure.
Collecting molds and fungi at that point.
Or maybe he thought Egon had like a blonde pompadour like in the cartoon show.
Yeah, he might have gotten the cartoon version mixed up.
After a bus ride to the New York Stock Exchange, which I mostly remember spending watching a couple in their 20s furiously making out in the seat in front of me.
I remember that too.
While our parents laughed, I tracked down Ramis again and asked him what other movies he had directed. Predictably, this is where Elliot's story runs off the rails.
What?
The movie in question that Ramis told me he directed was not Stuart Saves His Family, which despite being awful, actually got two thumbs up from Siskel and Ebert, but rather It's Pat, which considering its reported domestic gross of $60,822 was in fact a bomb.
Also, yeah, because Stuart Saves His Family was a huge hit. That those two thumbs up really made it, it really wrote it. It was the number three movie that year. It was the any which way you can of the year of release.
Also, my response was not that bomb, but actually, oh, that was a bomb. I actually don't remember Ramis mock choking me, but I believe it happened.
Well.
Fun side note, since I haven't mentioned sports yet.
How old was your brother at this point?
Like 10.
No, he doesn't fucking remember it. He was a kid.
Yeah, exactly.
Kids are stupid.
Fun side note, since I haven't mentioned sports
is
yet.
Is it going to be something about a sporting event around that time, and that's why he remembers it
Our
so
family
well?
Visited Dad's college roommate in California in 1992.
Yeah, this is how my brother remembers every date, is because what sports thing was going on at the time. I remember because the Rams were in the AFC Championship.
And while we were left at his house to play with his kids, he and our father went to a Los Angeles Kings game and sat in season tickets that belonged to none other than James Cameron. Lastly, Stuart, in person, I'm actually quite charming now that I'm not 10 years old anymore. Thanks for putting up with me, Dan and Stuart, because I'm Elliot's brother. He pretty much has to. Love, David, Elliot's brother.
You know, brothers kill each other all the time. Cain killed Abel. I don't have to put up with him.
So,
yeah, that was great.
Thanks for writing in and regaling us with that adventure story, Dave.
Yep.
I think you'll
thanks for giving me an excuse to check my phone during the podcast.
My version, I think, was slightly less accurate, but much shorter. It's called
more
storytelling.
Concise, he's got punch. It's got some Hawaiian punch behind it.
Yeah, because that's what I drink when I'm recording.
So now that we're done digging through our sack of letters.
Yep, the letter satchel. Close up those letters in the letter jail. Get back in your cells. I'm Dan the warden. Get back in your cells, letter jail. Don't make me turn on the hoses. No, no, we're letters. We can't take water. We'll just get all moldy and gross. Then it'll be easier to tear us because
really
we're wet.
Singing at this point.
Get back in there. Get back in. Starts hitting, and he has a riding crop, and he starts hitting it against the bars.
Sure.
You can sympathize with those letters if you want to, but I know what they did. Those animals deserve everything they got.
They're still human being letters, Dan. They have constitutional letter rights.
Stuart, do you have a recommendation of a movie?
Well, what I recommend is the recommendation segment.
This is a new segment. New
segment? It's a new segment we've done every episode. Where we recommend
since the
that
dawn
Dan,
of fucking time,
that,
I guess.
Where we recommend that Dan properly introduce the fucking segment instead of just going into it without saying what it is.
This is the last segment.
Have another Saratoga Lager, Dan.
Of the podcast. Well, we recommend movies that we actually liked.
Okay, so as opposed to the movie we just watched.
Which we did not like.
So I'm going to recommend...
More like Any Which Way You Can't, am I right?
You've been saving that up the whole podcast?
Yeah, I was hoping it would be my closer, till the end? No. But I couldn't hold it in.
No. So I'm going to recommend a movie that is currently streaming on cable demand or whatever.
A river runs through it, literally streaming.
Or if you're living in L.A. or New York, you can see it in the theater. It's a movie called Blue Ruin, a movie directed by the director of a movie that I recommended a long time ago called Murder Party. It's Blue Ruin is a little revenge story about a homeless guy who finds out that the killer of his parents is released from prison and he decides to take revenge. And it's, I would say, deliberately paced. It's patient. It's shot beautifully. There's not a ton of dialogue. And it's just an interesting little revenge story that really kind of sets, it really takes its time and kind of makes you very aware of where all the action's taking place. And yeah, it's really great. And it's already been loved by a lot of critics, so you've probably heard about it, but you should check it out.
What's it called? Blue Valentine?
Blue Ruin.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to recommend a movie called I Saw the Devil. Watched a little while back. It's a Korean revenge thriller. You can see it on Netflix. It's about a cop, kind of a super cop type, who...
So Jackie Chan.
...has his wife... Yes.
He's more of a police squad.
He's more of a RoboCop.
This cop has his wife killed by a serial killer and tracks the serial killer down, and instead of immediately dragging him in to face justice, he kind of engages him in a horrible cat-and-mouse game.
It's called Mousetrap.
Trying to make him feel...
That is a horrible game.
It's a terrible game. Never works right.
Mm-hmm. But he wants him to make him feel the same misery that he felt, which predictably backfires on him. You know, it allows the serial killer to sort of turn the tables on him. And of the Korean movies about revenge, and there have been many, it's not necessarily the deepest, but it is one of the most gruesome. So,
not the deepest, but perhaps the creepest.
Yeah.
But this is the guy who directed The Good, the Bad, and the Weird, which I think you recommended.
I recommended that a while ago, I think.
So, yes.
This is a much less fun movie than that, but it's still a pretty good movie.
It's pretty fun.
It's creepy,
gross fun.
What
about when he slashes that guy's Achilles tendon? That's hilarious.
Yeah, well, I don't know about hilarious.
That's my recommendation.
Is it my turn?
Yeah, it's your turn.
This is the part of the podcast where Elliot gets to recommend a movie.
It's called Recalendations. Recalendations.
Stop trying to brand it's called, your subsection of
Dan,
this segment.
Dan, this is the future. We're all mini entrepreneurs, and it's about branding. I got to build my brand.
Okay.
So anyway, welcome to Kalen's Corner.
Oh, boy.
Well, a lot of slow moving down here at Kalen's Corner. Life goes slow as it goes to a crawl.
Clop, clop, clop,
Foley
clop,
effects, clop, Foley
clop,
effects.
Clop, clop, clop.
That's my horse and my Foley effect guy. Here down at Kalen's Corner, we just sit and whittle and talk about movies. This time, I'd like to talk about a little movie I saw recently. Take it away, grandson Kalen. Thanks, Grandpappy.
I'm just giving a last joke and farewell. While you...
Okay, yeah, I don't know why
is
that's
Grandpappy
the...
Kalen flying off to heaven?
I don't know what that music was for. I mean, he did wink and there was a sparkle that came out of it, implying that maybe he was a ghost the whole time.
Yeah,
or perhaps a Mr. Miracle type or a Mr. Destiny type person.
The gates of the heavenly host open for him.
Yeah,
the
Destiny turns on the radio type figure.
He wanders in between the cornfield.
Destiny, turn off that radio.
This is my favorite song. Sure. Destiny's Child.
I have a headache.
Anyway, the movie I saw, this is a movie I've been wanting to see for a number of years, and I just, for whatever reason, never got around to do it, and I finally did. It's called...
How could Dolly Parton and James Woods be romantic leads? What a mismatched pair!
But it works. It works. Anyway, it's a Samuel Fuller movie that maybe you guys have seen, I know, called Shock Corridor, about a reporter who is trying to solve a murder in a mental asylum, and to do so, he's got to convince them he's crazy so he can get put in this mental asylum. So he forces his girlfriend to pretend that she's his sister and that he has sexual feelings for her so that they'll lock him up. And there are three witnesses to the murder, each with a different psychosis, and he's got to get through their psychoses to get to the truth before he goes insane himself. And the insanities of the different inmates are used to make different, you know, social political points. It's almost like a couple of different Twilight Zones were smashed together inside this mental hospital. But it's a very, at times, weird exploitation-y type movie, but never goes too far in that direction. It's a Samuel Fuller movie. So it's high quality, but it rides the edge of being like a crazy B movie. And I want to highlight in particular the performance of Larry Tucker, who is better known as a screenwriter and a producer, but plays the character a fat opera-singing character named Pagliacci, and his acting in it is so natural that it feels like a little bit like the movies you'd see with Marlon Brando where everyone else is acting and he's just kind of being, and Larry Tucker manages in a lot of the scenes to accomplish that where he just seems like this guy who lives in this mental institution, and it comes off as very natural. But otherwise, it's a fun, tight little thriller movie that's very weird at times. And I recommend it. Shock Corridor.
Well, guys, thanks for sharing the weirdness of Clint Eastwood and an orangutan with
me. There's no two guys I'd rather see Clint Eastwood and Sandra Locke have a threesome with an orangutan with than you two.
This is the end of our pod crawl.
Yeah, if you missed the first part, again, check out We Hate Movies and their... Their exhaustive exploration of Every Which Way But Loose.
And why not just check out We Hate Movies in general?
Yeah, man. Why not? We're not jealous. Of listeners cheating on us with a bad movie
podcast.
No,
we're open to that.
No, we get kind of into it.
Yeah, exactly. It's like
we sit in watching a chair.
Stuart sits in a chair and watches them.
Dan sits on the arm of that chair.
Listening to We Hate Movies.
Clinking the ice in his glass.
Yeah.
It's one of those scenes where you're sitting in a chair watching because you want to see it, but then when it gets too intimate, you like you flinch or you pull back. But that's when you feel the most pleasure.
That's why
well.
I wear a domino mask, alive. So I can shift the domino mask and cover my eyes.
Someone ends up strangled to death with a tie. It's awful.
It's a web of mystery and deceit.
Yeah.
But until all and the seduction. House of cards falls apart, it's very sexy.
A game of seductive cat and mouse.
Yeah.
In which a cat has sex with a mouse.
It's called
Tom and Jerry, an XXX parody.
All right. Well, thanks for listening to this nonsense. For the Flophouse, I've been Dan McCoy.
I've been Stuart Wellington.
I've been ashamed, but I'm also Elliot Kalin.
Good night, everyone.
Do, 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 do.
Into it.
You're a sexy nurse.
I'm a sexy nurse. And, I'm a nurse. Do you need some
you're a nurse
sex?
That's a little naughty.
Your doctor prescribed sex for you? Seems unlikely.
This is the most straightforward Doctor's Adventures episode from Brazzers I've ever seen.
Hi, I'm here for the sex doctor. That's me. Oh, yeah. Let's do it, I guess.
I prescribe 10 cc's of sex. All right.
That's not a lot.
Was that like a second? Yeah.
Well, they're getting treatment for sex addiction.
So. Yeah, they're trying to wean them off using Sexodone. Yeah.
Don't say wean around a sex addict. They totally think
they love that band.